Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I am your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 131 with Chris Prefontaine on the changing landscape of terms deals with sellers. Chris is a returning guest of the REI Diamond Show, having joined us almost 2 years ago now, sharing his strategies for pulling in $75,000 on average in total profit from deals with nowhere near $75,000 in equity, using lease option and other creative seller financing techniques. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Chris Prefontaine. How's it going today?
Very good. How about you, Dan?
I am doing well. We are in April, and our company, Diamond Equity, we're experiencing like a humongous influx of leads, which we typically see this time of year. I'm sure everybody in the real estate business is kind of in tune to that as well. It's just like, you know, humanity in the United States is transacting real estate come March, April, May. You know, it starts to slow off a little bit in the summertime, but man, it's a whole lot more activity and good things happening than like in December and January when we're all wondering if the business just stopped. We're going to get into some cool, interesting stuff, but is that the same cycle that you kind of like have found? And are you guys really busy right now too, Chris, or where you guys
at? It is in general. Yeah, no, as you were saying that, I was just thinking, it is in general, but what I try to do is I try to play off of that, meaning I, no matter what niche I was in, I would do this. But in our niche, I try to play off it a little bit in New England because people do shut down in, say, November, December, January. And so I'll position that with the sellers for urgency, you know, in every niche could, just saying, look, when do you think you're going to get more of your house, when everybody's fighting over it, or when there's no buyers whatsoever. So we create some urgency with them, meaning we go out with the only ones on the market is the theory. But you can create urgency around any season, but you are right in general, there's no question, and especially in New England.
Yeah, we found that, and then after this little digression, I'll get back to our main topic here, but we found that we're spending money for advertising. So we're not like, you know, relying on wholesalers, and we're not relying on the MLS and agents and network to bring us deals. They do bring us deals. Listeners of the podcast bring us deals. But the bulk of our deals comes from marketing, you know, TV ads, radio ads, Spotify ads, mail, et cetera. All that costs money. So we've learned to kind of dial down the budgets that time of year. Otherwise, we're fighting an uphill battle. But then we have like February and March where our settlement cycle really slows down, and it's kind of, for me at least, stressful watching that take place. Chris, enough about that little digression there. We've done the origination story. If anyone is listening and recognizes Chris's name, that's because he's been on the show here before. It was a very high energy, fast, bouncing back and forth episode with you and I. It was exciting. It was energetic. Because of the subject matter, because you're doing a huge number of deals, and you're doing a huge number of deals in a niche that we don't hear people often doing a huge number of deals, and that's lease options / terms deals. You know, people, in my experience, Chris, will do those kind of deals and are excited when they find like one seller that's willing to hold a mortgage on their property. And like for the most part, people are bringing cash to the table, paying hard money interest rates, 8, 10, 12%, flipping houses, refinancing them out. Conventional real estate investing 101 kind, I'll say. But you've done something unique in that you've scaled up and done this like large systematized volume of sandwich lease option deals. Had the owners carry him back, basically all terms deals. If I left anything out right there that you feel like listeners should be reminded of right now before we just kind of start our conversation about how your business has changed over the last year and a half since we've had you on the show here, fill us in right now if there's anything I missed there.
Not majorly. You did an awesome job. I would just say, so the lease purchase and the owner financing, yes, and to put a big explanation on that, just so everybody understands, give or take different markets, but roughly 25 to 33% of the properties out there are debt-free. So you've got a big pond to fish in for owner financing potentially, and we do those all principal only, no interest. So just to get people thinking.
Yeah, and it's like when we had our last conversation, I was like, yeah, this is great. We're going to build out this whole system. I've got like 15, 16, 17 people, not including like transaction coordinators in the markets that I'm in. The guys, I'm sure a lot of people do this kind of thing. We sort of get in a rut. We found a way to do a deal, you know, whether it's funding and flipping deal the old fashioned way. Maybe for you, it's the owner finance and the lease option, but we all kind of, I don't know if rut is the right word, but maybe like we get in our lane and we get good at what we're doing in our lane. And like for all my excitement and thinking I was going to convert the rest of the leads into lease options, like we haven't set up or done a single one yet. But that's not your story. So maybe kind of give a little background about your business has grown since we last talked. You know, how did you get to that growth? What does the team look like? What are these like associative partnerships that you put together?
Sure. So on both fronts, thank you for saying both ends of that. So on the buying in family here, we buy New England, mainly Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. We've put that on total autopilot, meaning I've been removed from the actual buying and selling directly. My son-in-law, Zach, who I think you met on your show as well, he was doing a lot of the buying. He's now even added some VAs, so he's removed himself from a lot of the day-to-day as well. And so that just chugs along, literally, on autopilot. And I'll say this to anyone, not coming out of the gate, but down the road, you can get to that point where you're working your real estate business, in our niche anyway, two and a half days, that would be super strong after your learning curve. I don't want to set the wrong impression here. And so Zach was able to do that, and Zach came to in the business as my son-in-law with zero experience. So I'm not saying someone has to have experience. I'm saying just a little bit of time to get through that learning curve. And then on the associate front that you mentioned, we have associates just like you and I all around the country that do deals with us. And when I say do deals with us, we coach them as they do deals. We lock arms with them. We do it with them. We call their sellers. We call their buyers. Someone on our team is involved in that deal with them. And I just see, Dan, and this has changed a lot since, say, a year and a half ago, the gap in the industry, especially in my niche, from people going to a seminar or reading a book or seeing a course and doing deals, that gap is enormous, and it's a bummer. So every week I have people saying to me, yeah, but I didn't get any deals done. Well, I actually know how to do deals if I go through your system. The answer is yes. That's what we're all about. I'm not about selling stuff. I'm about doing deals. And we've got about 65 people now on my radar. There's a whole bunch more that aren't on my radar that are doing deals. And that's different. You know, you walk into a RIA, you say how many people have done a deal in a local market. You might get a few raise their hands, a few. We had our event a few weeks ago. I said, how many people have done a deal? 60% of the hands went up. And so it's just different. And we're trying to close that gap big time.
Nice. Yeah, I was in the business like 3 or 4 years, and I remember the first early deals. So like we went to the seminars, we got the education, we couldn't afford to do the mentor, and they didn't have like a sharecropping system, if you will, which would be like, you know, you're bringing a deal to the table, the person who is giving you the mentoring and the guidance and hopping on the phone calls. I mean, it works best when you have a vested interest, that other party. And you're splitting the deal. So, you know, you're sharing in what's taking place on the deal. We didn't have any of that offered to us at the time in the beginning. And I ended up, it felt like a miracle. The first like 25, 30 deals just felt like a miracle every time. It was like, I couldn't believe we were finally getting another deal. But then it was when the market changed and started to come back. So I was in 4 or 5 years before I finally found somebody who we made a loose arrangement with. To get deals done. And, you know, this guy, Josh, who was also on the show, he was that guy for me. And I can't speak highly enough of our arrangement. And it was never really defined the way that I'm sure yours are defined with your associates there, or people listening might be able to define with somebody. But he was doing the type of deals I was trying to do at the time. It was wholesale deals. We do a lot more flipping the old conventional way. Now, and I found a guy who was doing those deals, and I was willing to bring to the table my leads, and he was willing to work them, get them sold, get them settled, deal with the title issues, hop on and negotiate with the buyers, basically do a whole lot of stuff and bring a whole bunch of value to the table. And it really supercharged my career because it allowed me to get really good at the other angles of the business before finally I outgrew him and I was able to do the business on my own. But I didn't stumble into that guy until like 5 years into the business. So Wow. I just can't speak highly enough for people who are in the first, 6 months, a year, maybe you've been trying this, trying that. Like, man, if you can find somebody, you got to bring something of value to the table also, whether that's the leads, the deals, maybe that's in addition to a little bit of, cost for coaching and things of that nature to show your commitment. But, two parties committed with the same shared interests are going to excel, much further than one person on their own trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, and you probably owe that, not owe meaning literally, but you must be very, a lot of gratitude towards that person who helped you, because they closed that gap. I made that up, but they closed that gap between you doing deals and you not doing deals, and obviously you're a huge success now. So that's awesome, whoever did that with you.
Yeah, thank God. That was Josh Hertz. I'll link to his episode in the show notes. I'll also obviously link to yours that we mentioned earlier, and also Zach Beach episode. That's your son-in-law, so I'll make sure I put all those in the show notes here for this
great
one as well.
That's really cool. Thanks.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so here's the big elephant in the room, I feel like. I've heard of another company, a big startup. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Divvy Homes is operating in Atlanta, where I'm operating. They're funded, Silicon Valley style, so they're buying these houses for cash, and they are utilizing real estate agents in the local market to basically run people through their program, their underwriting, et cetera. And they pack in some rental increases and they pack in some, appreciation for when they cash out, and they're counting on the cash out. I have no idea what the economics of that business are. I kind of mystery shopped them to kind of see their business, and the way that you're doing the business comes with a lot less risk than buying the property for cash. I assume that company is really counting on the cash out. And I also know that from the last time you and I talked, and even when Zach and I had our episode here, you were really interested in seeing your tenant buyers, your occupants cash out of the deal, meaning they are actually acting on and, closing out the option. They're getting a mortgage and they're buying out the previous owner. They're buying out you and you're taking a profit. And usually that's a pretty solid, substantial portion of the profit on a lease option deal. What has been the success rate? And are there any things that you guys have done as a company to help improve that over the last year and a half that you feel like would be like really big takeaways for someone else listening now?
Yeah, sure. Takeaway in a sense of confidence if they want to do it, but also actual takeaway if they're already doing it. And that is, and it ties to the Divvy Home story, I believe. So I think I know what you're talking about. And that is the front end of this process with the buyers. In order to get to a 92% success rate, which is about what we're running, that varies by a few percentage points, you've got to be extremely strict and follow protocol with the buyer. And what does that mean? This is where we've tightened up, because we've been at it long enough now to see the headaches. So we've tightened up how we accept them. We've tightened up to get to that point. They've got to not just go through the credit screening company to see if they can even do this down the road, or you're setting them up to fail. But now we've also added a mortgage broker component. He also does lease purchase deals, so he totally understands it. And he also works hand in hand with our credit enhancement company. So there's two major hoops there that they have to jump through. And third, they've got to have enough money down, Dan. I can't stress this enough, and I think this is where Divvy Homes is going to fall if I'm thinking of the right company. You cannot put a buyer, I don't care what kind of plan you think you have them on, you cannot put a buyer in a home for little down or no down. All you have is a renter with a hope to get a house, and that the inverse relationship, I promise you, will happen. They'll have maybe 8 or 10% cashing out, and the rest will not cash out. And do they really care? I'm not trying to trash them. But do they really care? No, they've gone out of the market with the next cycle. They're investors. I don't knock it. That's just their model. We're in it for a long haul. We've got an A+ Better Business Bureau rating, and that's not easy to protect. And we're a family company. That's different. And so the short answer is pre-qualifying the buyers tremendously better. And on the back end, the seller end, to buffer yourself from the market and any headaches, getting longer terms on either owner financing or lease purchase, because longer terms gives you enough runway to do whatever you need to do to pivot as well. I hope I answered that for you.
Yeah, you did. You hit the nail on the head. And I think that, the other thing, they're buying property, from what I know, I could be totally wrong in my assumption of that company, but I assume, and I've heard through the grapevine, they're buying with cash. So they're like owning these properties. And yeah. I think they're buying them at nearly market rate. And if we take a market like Atlanta, you know, I would assume and guess that their risk mitigation, you know, is that the Atlanta market is continuing to go up. And we've seen a lot of appreciation in that marketplace, and the population and the jobs are still growing. So we'd expect that to continue at least into the, you know, I'd say 3 to 5, maybe 7 year horizon without any catastrophic changes. Still, I would guess just from my own ownership of my rental properties that I have, man, the maintenance just kills me. And I wonder, like, is that built in? I don't know if it is, but like the maintenance costs added into buying it at like not really a discount, it's got to be a recipe for disaster. When you do your deals, and I know we talked about this before, are there any things you shifted? And if not, maybe just kind of give us a little repeat of what you're doing to like avoid the risks I just mentioned that that other company, I believe, is facing.
Yeah. So on the maintenance thing, it's really this: during the buyer pre-screen process, number one, we do offload the maintenance to the buyers because the buyers, they're buyers. They're not, you know, I'm not saying renters, they're buyers. They just need time, and the time vehicle is a lease. But so what we do is I'm going to paint a picture of a guy I just met with 2 weeks ago because my son was out of town. I met with him. He usually handles the buyers. This is your perfect buyer that I say you should put in a home versus what some of the other people are doing for, you know, 1 to 5 or 8 grand down. This gentleman is self-employed, so his credit is good. He just needs time for seasoning to get a loan. This gentleman makes about 5 or 6 times what he could qualify for, what he needs to make to be in my house, to qualify to get my house. This gentleman gave me a plan to not only put down over $60,000 on a $400-something thousand home. Okay, that's good ratio. But he also has a plan to do the basement over and add a sunroom, and has given me those dates. So that's built into his agreement. So I know he's improving the property. I know he's treating it like his house, not a tenant. And if you're putting people in houses and you're putting little down, they are a tenant. They act and behave like a tenant. So that's the big difference, Dan. I don't know if I deviated too much on you that one.
No, you really did. And then some of it, right? So you're doing a sandwich lease option. What would be the majority of the structure of your deals? I mean, are 60% you know, owner financed, like you mentioned early on, or is it 60% or maybe a different percentage that are like a sandwich lease option, meaning lease with an original owner who stays on deed until you cash out the property? Or is there a third method that you guys are using right now at all that I don't know about?
We shifted a little bit just so as the market shifts. I think you and I were talking off the show about this. When the market shifts, you want to just be aware of it, be cognizant of it, be networking with people that are also. So our shift is this. We are doing much more cognizant of doing subject to and owner financing deals. Because with the subject to, there is no end date. With an owner financing, I can build in extensions, you know, 5-7 years out. We did recently our own office building at 20 years, and another deal we're looking at 10 years. Well, those are cool deals because you have time for the market to do whatever it needs to do. And so percentage-wise, I would tell you that we've now shifted internally very carefully to do, you're probably talking a third sandwich and a third owner financing. And the other third is made up of not just subject to, it's about half subject to and half assign outs. We probably didn't even talk about these, but it's how I started 6.5, whatever years ago, where I would set up the deal like a sandwich, but then I would get the tenant buyer and assign it over to the seller. We do a lot of those because then we're out of the deal. Not as lucrative. One payday, not three paydays. You know, 25, 28 grand versus 75 grand. But they're good deals to mix into your portfolio so you can turn some quick cash. And they're also great for new people. So I have a student right now in Arkansas on her second, I call them AOs, assign out deals, because in and out, money in, money out, and then you get to go spend some more time and some more energy and effort on deals you can stay in longer term. Because remember, if you do an owner financing deal or a subject to, and you're telling the owner, I'm not putting any money down, which is what we do, you are going to be expected to probably pay the transfer tax for them. You can expect them to come out of pocket to sell you their home. And so that might be $1,000 or $1,500. So you do need a teeny bit of money if you're going to do those deals, and that is big, big upside. So I say do them.
Yeah, and I'm in marketplaces, Chicago and Philadelphia, both with high transaction costs. And so it wouldn't be unreasonable on a $400,000 purchase where the owner was like, hey, yeah, pay me, you know, $1,200 a month until the 400, whatever, we negotiate that. Yeah. But it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect to have to come to closing with anywhere from like 10 to even 15 or $20,000 to cover all the closing costs. I think probably between 10 and 15 would be realistic on that. So you got a point with, you know, it's not exactly no money type of deals.
Yes. So here's what I say to do, Dan. Let me just say this is important. So when we structure paydays 1, 2, and 3, you get to, after your first year, know that from the first year's activity, you have scheduled payday 2s and 3s coming out. Those are your monthly incomes, your cash outs. So in year two, those start. So for us now, we're talking 6.5, whatever years in, we have a closing or two every single month that's a payday 3 cash out where the buyer and the seller are happy, we'll get to the end zone. We have scheduled deposits from payday 1 scheduled out for probably 4 years. I could stop working today for a year and say, hey, Dan, here's my spreadsheet on my cash flow, and I don't have to do Zippo. So it's worth building this thing for 24 to 36 months, and that's why I tell people, students everywhere, give this thing 3 years and you'll have a phenomenal experience. Don't dip your toe in saying you want to try it. And I mean that for any niche, but especially because we have the three paydays that get created.
Yeah, I could see it being a hassle. Like you set up a deal, 1, 2, 3 paydays, and you set up like 2 or 3 of those deals, and then you get bored and you're on to something else. Now it's like it's aggravation for the $500, $600, $800 a month cash. And then you forget about it, and then they never cash out, and it's just like a total disaster. I know we talked about it before, but let's talk about the 1, 2, 3 paydays. What exactly are they? And I assume they're going to be on the three deals we just talked about. A third each would be like the sandwich lease option, the owner finance deal. Each would have a 1, 2, and 3. And then let's talk about what happens on the assign out and dive into some detail there as a wrap up for that piece.
Sure. So you're absolutely correct on all our exits except the AO, which we'll come back to. They are all three paydays. So payday 1 is the buyer coming to the table with enough down payment so you know they're a buyer and they have skin in the game. Like the guy I mentioned was going to buy, and the bank said, well, no, you need seasoning. And he said, okay, I'll just redirect that $60,000. So that's payday 1. Do they always come in up front? No. Some are, say, $20,000 now and $20,000 the next 2 tax refund years. We do a lot of those, and that's how we've maximized our payday 1s. So our payday 1 average is about $28,000. Payday 2s are those thin ones that you just mentioned. That's that $300 to $1,000, maybe $200 to $1,000 per month net cash flow. The presentation I did the other night on a live webinar for Canadians was, look, here's the last 12 months what we created for brand new payday 2s, and it was a net of $6,500 a month in income. Now, it didn't count 1 or 3, and I said to them, that was created. I don't want to sound facetious and say out of thin air, but in the last 12 months, new deals that came into our company was a net payday 2 of $6,500 a month. That's a game changer for some people. And payday 3 is when you cash out at the end. And what's that made up of in year 2, 3, 4, 5, 10? That's made up of the pay down in the underlying debt that took place over the term, because that accrues to you, the investor, or the complete principal pay down in an owner financing deal, because all ours are structured with 100% principal pay down. And so if you add up those paydays, depending on the term, $28,000 or so up front on payday 1, 30 something on the back, and then the middle, they range around $75,000 for us. Our students run from $45,000 to $110,000. So that's a rough average for you on all three paydays. On the AO, to answer that question, they're obviously not as lucrative because you're basically getting payday 1. That's it. And then you assign everything back, you release all liability to the owners and to the buyers, and you're gone. So the good news is no more tie. The not so good news is you didn't get as much money over time. You got to go do it again. And I'm a big proponent of don't go do a deal that in order to get paid. You got to go do another deal because then you get a job.
Yeah, even though those deals seem like large money when you first get started. Can we just run through, not like the sexiest, biggest, you know, the one you want to give on a presentation to get everyone excited, but how about like what is a realistic, reasonable, you know, a student of yours maybe did as their third or fourth assign out deal. Can we like just run through what those numbers look like in this scenario just so people could get an idea of what an assign out would look like?
Yeah, I can give you a tiny one. Yeah, the one in Arizona was tiny. I was just working on it with her today, so I'll try to think of the numbers. I use round numbers. Her name is Jen. Jen sent me a deal where the owners wanted – I actually did the call with her. I called into the kitchen table meeting when she was with this nice couple. They were great. They understood it. They wanted $145. I'm going to use round numbers. $145 for their house. Jen said, okay, I'm going to go to market at $169.9, comp support somewhere in the 160s, and I'm going to tell you that we're probably going to get a buyer that can cash you out in 3 years. But I'm going to collect a non-refundable down payment, and I'm going to give you 20% of it. I'm keeping the rest, and then you're going to own this buyer. She had, now this is not the norm for how many buyer calls she had, maybe because it was low end. She had well over 400 or 500 calls. She took 5 or 6 strong applications with my son's help. It's kind of what we do. And then we, because you whittle down, a lot of them call in their renters. And then she ended up structuring a deal, and I remember it almost exactly. We just did it today. And the down payment was like $16,400, real good for a house. It's almost, it's like 10%. $16,400 down. So let's use round math here. 170 and 145, that's the spread, right? 170 went to market for, 145 they wanted. So that's what? 35 grand, if I'm right? Or is it 25 grand? 25 grand. So 25,000 spread. Now, if she took the $16,400, but because that's where she gets her pay, the owners get to pick up all the rest. They were only expecting 145. They're going to get the rest at the cash out, the back end of the thing. So they're tickled pink. A lot of the assign outs work like that because you don't know what you're going to come in with for down payment. But on Jen's side, she gets the $16,400 and away she goes. So it's a big win-win. And now they have another property they want to give her. So that's not a windfall, but that's 16 grand in about 3 weeks' work.
Yeah, which is actually a windfall for a lot of people. I mean, let's just
I guess
be
I
honest,
shouldn't downplay
right?
it. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, that's a life changer. If there's a somebody like my first deal was $16,400. Mine was $6,000 and that was a life changer. So $16,400, that sign out the owner of record in that instance there, Chris. How much did they end up with as like security deposit, first month's rent, et cetera? Was there some other money that changed hands there? Or was it like $16,400 was all they had and she just like assigned it to them and then start paying the rent?
Okay, so how it works is out of that $16,400, remember I said they took 20%. We have agreed up front we'd give the owners 20%. So Jen had a let out of the $16,400, whatever that comes to, $3,200, $3,300. That went to them.
Gotcha.
They were happy because in their mind, they thought they had at least cover the next month because the way we do the AO deals is if our tenant buyer is taking possession on May 1, we're taking that first month. You're going to have them paying you starting June 1. So that 20% upfront helped them cover that little buffer. And they get their own principal pay down throughout the deal, not us. They get their own monthly spread above their mortgage, not us. And they get the back end rest of that profit. Is there a security or first or last or any of that? No. Because that implies tenant. These are buyers, and they have a lease purchase agreement. There's a big difference.
Gotcha. So the does something like this, the assign outs, I imagine that a brand would help with this scenario. So, like, you know, you're doing your first one, you don't really have a bunch of calls, and the property's going to generate a certain number of calls. But, like, after you've done – you know, 40, 50, 60 of these kind of deals. Like, how important is it to be cognizant for you, your students, anyone doing this, to kind of build up a brand as the, you know, lease option buyer program
yeah.
provider in your marketplace?
Yeah, I love it. This is important. If you look at the trends now in business, especially millennials, but I'm talking big businesses right now on out there, billion-dollar businesses, they're talking about being that expert, being that authority in your marketplace and driving your business that way. Well, what we do, noticing that you asked what's changed in a year and a half, we've put in place a national property team. A national property team provides them kind of like an association umbrella for no extra cost, and it allows them to be on that website. It allows them to say, look, I'm part of this national group, and together we control, you know, X amount of hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars worth of real estate, and that's the credibility. And then we've recently, I'm talking like 2 months ago, tied a Better Business Bureau component to that, which the Better Business Bureau now honors, which is amazing. And so these guys are going and getting accreditation in their local marketplace before being in business for 6 months or 12 months, which a lot of markets demand. And so it's not a given that every marketplace is going to accept it, but so far it's happened. And that's a big, big issue to your point. And lastly, we're starting to teach our higher level members. We call them our high six. We just put this in place and we're going to roll it out heavy in the fall, what we call the authority sprint. And so in 90 days, we teach them, and this is not for the new person, this is someone who's already got their feet wet. We teach them how to become the authority in their marketplace and have people literally coming to them and watching what they're doing, like you've done with, say, with the podcast, you know, be the authority in your marketplace.
Yeah, it's smart. The trend that I notice. So I got into business in 2006 in real estate. Zillow was like a brand new invention, and it was like not that great at providing the info. But it was like it's a different world now in real estate investing than it was back then. And it was typically run, our industry, by mom and pop localized investors. You know, you might hear about the guy who piled up 100, 200, 300 single family houses. But me, I never really met the guy who had 10,000. And it was always said, like, you know, the banks would try to get into real estate and they would always, you know, just be like too much problems, too localized, too niche. And it was going to always be dominated by the mom and pop. But then a weird thing happened after the recession. We saw Blackstone and a ton of Wall Street firms come in and institutionalize single family rental business, which we normally saw dominated by the local players. So where we had forever, going back, you know, in time, the industry that's driven by the local mom and pop, you know, the people who are listening to this podcast and are just going to get started and they're having 2, 3, 4 rentals and, you know, they're not planning to do 10,000. I think we're starting to see a trend, and maybe you would have some insight on this, where we're seeing bigger and bigger businesses get involved, like we mentioned with Divi on the lease option homes. Like we have the Open Door and Zillow now buying houses. I think Redfin might be starting a home buying program. I know that my business has gotten a lot easier for us to buy houses and generate leads as we gotten to be, you know, kind of the big gorillas in the market that we're in. We're buying a lot of houses every month in each of the marketplaces that we're in, and our brand provides that momentum, which gives us a push. And my cost per lead, Chris, I see it going up and up and up. And it's like, man, I don't even know if I could start over and kind of like build the same business model without the momentum that we have today, especially when I'm trying to compete against Open Door and I'm getting Silicon Valley money's coming in and you got Divi who's out here buying these properties for cash at like, you know, full retail value. And so I see this like this trend where much more thought needs to be given if you're planning on being successful in the real estate business to like developing your brand or aligning yourself with someone who already has that brand in your marketplace. I mean, what would you say about all that?
Well, I think you're, you know, 100% spot on. So here's a thought, so people don't get nervous about that, because they kind of should, to what you said. They should go, whoa, what am I going to do then? Well, what you should do is you align. Okay, so whoever, whatever niche you like, and I'm not so naive and Dan's not so naive to think, oh, well, our niche is it. Of course not. So whatever niche you like, you've got to align yourself with that, because that's like a steamroller now. Like picture this, and Dan kind of alluded to it. So we have all these associates now nationally who are getting together every week on Zoom and getting together twice a year physically. And so we hear stuff, our ears to the ground, just like you, Dan. So they'll go, well, this is going on with the buyers, and this is going on with Divi Homes, and this is going on over here. So what do? We make tweaks real quick, and we do it right across the board nationally. Well, for the individual investor not to be tied to something or someone or like that vehicle, that's a tough road to hoe. And the market is changing, to your point, so quickly. It's not gonna slow down. It's just gonna go faster and faster with technology. And so, yeah, I think that groups like yours, groups like ours, are absolutely keeping a major foothold in the market. And it's going to be different even 5 years from now, entirely different. So I think that's where you're going. But I couldn't agree more with you how you said that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it is. Cool. All right. So let's switch gears and do a little bit of entertaining right now. I need you to come clean on, you know, the horror stories of what you've seen. Maybe like, you know, the sellers that took some real delicate navigating to get back out of an issue. Like let's hear some of the things that, you know, that might scare the average person off.
I'm an open book, you know that, so I that's why I laugh. I'll tell it. I tell it every event. We had one recently. I have a soft spot for veterans, right? I want to help them, and I think a lot of people do. So we put a veteran in the home, my son and I, and we look back on what were we thinking about. So about 2.5 years ago, we put one in, and he just didn't have the money, and frankly, from meeting him, we should not have accepted him. We wouldn't today. Well, long story short, he goes in the home, and from probably the third month on, he did not act and behave and pay for things like a buyer. He acted, behave, and pay for things like the worst tenant you could ever ask for. And so we had to fight every single month to get paid. And finally, it came to an end where he knew and his girlfriend knew, look, we just can't maintain this anymore. We got to get out of here. So they left. They finally left. It was not easy, but they left. So I go out there. I was the fortunate one to do the walkthrough. And Dan, when I tell you, this like brings me back to when I used to just do rentals. When I tell you this place was gross, there was dog feces, there was windows hanging. Literally, I could push a window and it'll come out of the house. I could go on and on. The list was crazy. So I got prices. I used to build. I still do. I'm building my own house. It was going to cost like 30-something grand to go through this house. And now what's my obligation to the seller? My obligation to the seller is at the end of 2019, I'm supposed to cash this thing out. So now, here's the caveat. So important to have the right agreements. So all our agreements with the lease purchase, this is a lease purchase, by the way. I'm not on title. He is. All the lease purchase agreements have a clause that says we can assign the home back to the seller. It should be morally and ethically in the same condition, but we can assign it back to the seller. So I called up Dave and I said, Dave, I got an issue going on. I lost my guy. He goes, yeah, geez, the neighbors told me it was a mess, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay. So we have two choices, Dave. We can assign this house back to you, or, and I don't think you want it after my walkthrough, or I can spend some money on this thing and I'll do it because I can use my other payday ones and threes from other deals, right? So he doesn't know that. I said, I can spend some money on it. But I need you to extend this thing 18 months before your cash out. Now his cash out, he's waiting for the payoff of his mortgage and he's waiting for about 10 grand. It's not like it's a huge amount. So, he said in one simple, conversation, he said, let me check with my wife, who is his second wife, and I'll get back to you. The next one, I got a text, we're game, sent us the agreement to extend it. So I'm in that house fixing that up. I'll put another tenant buyer in and we'll get them cashed out. Now, that was a pivot that had to happen. And I talk about pivoting all the time because it's usually on the buyer end where we screwed up and put him in and we shouldn't have. And you've got to pivot. If he said absolutely not, morally and ethically, I probably would have gussied it up, not given it back to him, and put on the market right away for sale by owner or with a realtor and just broke even and got out of there. So, so your exit's not terrible, but we turned it into another profit center is what we did.
Nice. And you're making a payment to him for the 2-3 months while that thing's vacant, right? I think it's important to highlight
that. We are absolutely,
little.
Yeah, we're paying his mortgage. So here's what I tell people. I had one of our students have a husband go into an illegal marijuana business out of the garage and the wife passed away. And I said, are you stressed out? And he said, no. When they gave me their payday one, it was like 28 grand. I put half of it aside. So yes, you're going to be stuck for 2 or 3 months. And so should you run your business smart and put aside, in our case, all our payday twos or at least partial payday ones? Yeah, you should start a reserve. So when that happens, you don't stay up worrying about it at night and you should have lines of credit so you don't worry about it at night. Both of those things I teach the students for sure. Good point.
Yeah, and it's like I remember being taught the sandwich lease option originally back in 2006 at those Get Rich in Real Estate Quick seminars, and they would talk about like that same kind of a scenario. Oh, yeah, you could just give it back to the seller. But like I always had the hesitation, especially back then when I didn't have money set aside to do it. I never would want to get into those deals because I wouldn't want to end up in that position where the vet trashed a place. And now I got to basically screw the seller and say, here, take this thing back because maybe I might not have been in a position to like cover the repairs and do the right thing, even though in the contract and the clauses of the contract, right, totally legally could hand that property back and just say, here it is. Here's your giant mess. But, you know, knowing that we do the right thing, and I think most people listening to, you know, to us right now would agree, like, yeah, I got to do the right thing by these people. Like if I told them I'm going to pay the mortgage and they're counting on me to do that, whether it's for the 18 months or 36 months or, you know, my 6 months while it's vacant, while I'm cleaning the place up, while I'm, you know, putting the money back in to get it back to usable condition again, you know, that's the right thing and, like, got to do it.
Yeah, there's kind of a moral and ethical code. Like we have values for the company, but one of them is real simple. You weigh decisions with, you have a financial and you have what's right, period. You said do what's right. It's like a saying, DRT. So you do what's right, period. And if you do that, you're going to come out in the long run way better because now that guy's glowing and telling everybody, you know, they held their own. We extended them a little bit, but they're okay. And we didn't try to stick it to them. But I want people to know that you've got to be able to pivot. And at every one of our seminars and in our book originally, there's all pieces of what can go wrong so that when you do hit it, you don't go, oh, it's only me. No, it happens. You just have to know how to pivot and you have to run your business the right way.
Chris, are there any instances where you are looking at somebody ready to give you the largest down payment for a lease option, but you did not select that candidate? If so, what would be the reasoning why you didn't select them?
There is one. When you started the question, I'm thinking, yep, I got one. So my attorney in Massachusetts, so we do three different states. I was on my way to his office to do the final closing. So I already had an initial buyer's meeting, gave us a grand binder, coming to the closing with 40-something grand. Well, John calls me. Now, John, sadly enough, has passed away since then. He's my attorney and really good friend. But he called me in the car, and he said, Chris, I don't think you want to do this, but it's your call ultimately. I said, why? He said, this guy's got 40-something grand cash. And he told me that his dad and him just collected a bunch of rents from their property. That's where they got it. And he said, you do what you want, but I'm telling you, that's not where he got it. And so John told me he couldn't be accepted and couldn't go forward without a cashier's check, and that pretty much took care of him. He was gone. So, you know, 45 grand is a lot of money, but that there's something screwy there, clearly. And that's not the first time. One of our students had something like that happen in Arizona, and those are going to come up once a year. Look, when you're in the business, you get all kinds of weird things coming on with buyers and sellers, mostly buyers. And you just have to make sure, again, do what's right, do what's moral and ethical. And there's always a better buyer. That house actually resold to a much stronger buyer. I think that one might have even cashed out by now. So there's always a better buyer around the corner. Don't go to that, I got to pay the mortgage, or I got to have that check.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. And when you said the guy had 40, 45,000 cash, you mean like in a bag, right, Chris? He showed up at the attorney's office with like cash in a bag.
He literally had cash, bringing it to an attorney's office like everything was peachy, hunky-dory. Now, my attorney said, look, I have an escrow account. I can take it. I would never tell you to, but I could take it, put it in, and disperse if you want me to, but I don't advise it. And I said, no, move on.
Yeah, that's a huge red flag. Huge red flag. Cool. I have one. Before I ask my final question for you, before we do our little wrap-up here, I would like you to answer, or did I forget to ask any questions that you feel like we should answer right now? If so, what would the question be and what would the answer be?
No, your flow is phenomenal and I enjoy chatting with you. So no, I'm good. Whatever you want to go with next.
Cool. So it's been a year, year and a half, whatever it's been since you've been on the show. If you had something you could go back and share with yourself, a revelation, some kind of, you know, little directionary growth tip for yourself, just a year and a half ago before you kind of, you know, grew, scaled up and got to the place where you're at now, you know, what would that look like, that little tip you'd give yourself?
I think it would go back to, because it was a touch more than a year and a half ago, we did our show. I think it would go back to that authority, that be the authority in your marketplace. I wish someone taught me or exposed me to that earlier. I'm not saying I would have accepted it. Who knows where my head was back then. But I think being the authority sooner would have been the way to go. And if the listeners can take that away from this, whatever the heck you're doing, I don't care if you're out running a restaurant, be the authority in your market, and there's a way to do that. That would be what I wished I had done earlier and you know, taking the advice earlier, or someone gave it to me earlier.
Yeah, true enough. The same thing where we were talking about with the brand, like it's, you know, yeah. There's people doing the lease option business out there, and I know when we've taken stabs at it and people are hesitant to give you the first down payment and, oh, you're not the guy on the title. And there's people out there pulling rental scams in the marketplace. And so like the
right.
more authority you have in that marketplace, the easier it is to collect not only the $1,000, you know, that they're serious, but then the 30, the 40, the 50 to $60,000 that you're expecting them to bring to the closing table on this lease option. I digress. So, Chris, you and the team have been working on a book. Do you want to kind of take the spotlight there and share what you're up to and what's coming down the pike?
Yeah, I'd love to, and I appreciate you bringing it up. It's called The New Rules of Real Estate. Coming off of my bestseller, the kids and I have been chatting them for a while about, I call them kids, though, 29 and 30, Zach and Nick. But they're talking about getting a book out and all these ideas that have come up since the last one and the feedback. So this one's called The New Rules of Real Estate. 24 leading experts that are a combination of people that have been on my show and Zach and Nick, because they come from entirely different backgrounds. Nick grew up in the family business. Zach had zero experience. And then we mixed in some really big names in there like Dr. Joe Vitale and some cool people to really work on the mindset piece. So it is 24 different experts, and it mixes all kinds of niches. It's not just our niche, because I want people to be exposed to some personal development and coaching in a bunch of different niches, so they can either A, say I want to go into that niche and make it my niche, or B, I'm big already in my niche. I want to add this as a profit center, which we get a lot. And so we're getting, with our pre-release of the manuscript, we've gotten better feedback than our bestseller did because of the diversity of it. And it'll be come out on May 14th, Dan, on Amazon. If they do it between 12 and 1 in the afternoon to help us drive that little effort, we're doing it at half price. And we're going to add some gifts to that. And if they have any questions on that, they can just email support and we can help them out with getting involved in that effort.
Cool. Sounds good. Is there any other contact information or websites maybe you'd want to direct listeners to visit if they want some more information about you or the company?
Yeah, so go to smartrealestatecoach.com. If you want to see how to get the book at 50% and be part of that exciting day on May 14th, just email support@smartrealestatecoach.com. And you were nice enough to mention the show a few times. That's smartrealestatecoachpodcast.com. And I do appreciate that, Dan.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, Chris, I appreciate you taking the time out and, you know, blocking out the distractions and sharing so candidly the ins and outs of your business. Really appreciate that. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. Thanks for having me again. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Have you ever wondered why I do the REI Diamond Show? If you've listened to other podcasts like I have, real estate or otherwise, you probably notice that most have some type of agenda. Hosts often have advertisers or offer coaching and seminar programs, while I have none of that here on the show. The REI Diamond Show is and has been a labor of love for me. I love having guests come on the show and share their jewels of wisdom, and I love sharing those experiences with you here on the show. My life has changed as a result of doing this show and continuing to do this show, picking up and implementing new strategies, discovering new markets, having access to better investment opportunities, and the list goes on. I hope that you receive similar value from your time investment here with me, listening to the REI Diamond Show. Maybe if you have, you wouldn't mind heading over to iTunes, finding the REI Diamond Show, and writing a quick review. I appreciate the effort, and it will help others to find us here as well. And if you haven't already done so, please remember to subscribe so you can catch the next episode. Speaking of the next episode, Baltimore investor Sakar Kale joins us here on the show to talk about his journey from a 9-to-5 job, building a portfolio of more than 200 units over the last 15 years. He shares a wealth of experience ranging from the best mindset to deal with your contractors to the benefits of owning a scaled real estate investment portfolio and why you might want to, if you haven't already, do the same. Even some gems outside of real estate. I've really enjoyed creating this episode, and I know you'll enjoy listening, so you'll want to catch that one. You know that I am the president and founder of Diamond Equity Investments, right? We are, as a company, on track to buy more than 200 houses this year spread throughout Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Florida, the markets where we currently operate. So if you have a deal, preferably one that I can fix and flip, please send it over. Add me to your buyers list or contact me directly at reidiamonds.com. Also at reidiamonds.com, you can check out the entire archive of the REI Diamond Show, totaling more than 130 content-rich, money-making, idea-packed episodes. We have reached the end, my friend. Thanks again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here. Catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.